There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 110. I'm currently recording this in a hotel room in Montreal. The Just for Laughs Festival is going on outside. It's loud. Can you hear it? It's loud. There are clowns in the streets. Literal clowning going on. And I'm losing my voice, having to shout over loud clowns. But I do want to say that if you're in Los Angeles, August 6th, we are doing a Nerdist Podcast live at Meltdown, a.k.a. Nerd Melt, with the Guild cast and creators, a.k.a. Felicia Day and everyone else on the show. So please, please, please come to that. We're going to have so much fun. They're going to screen some upcoming episodes. Tickets for that are at Nerdist.com. In the sidebar, we'll take you to the ticket link. So join us on that August 6th. Also like to thank our continuing sponsor for the Nerdist Podcast, GoToMeeting, brought to you by Citrix. GoToMeeting.com is amazing conferencing software. If you've ever tried to do a meeting online, you know that it is a pain in the nards. So GoToMeeting, you can start everything in seconds. Everyone can join your meeting in seconds. You will look like you actually know what you're doing. They will provide everything for you. Super easy to use. Reduce meeting-related expenses. You also get voiceover IP. It's great. So please, please, please sign up today for a free 30-day trial if you need good conferencing. Have all the meetings you want for one low flat rate. GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and enter the promo code Nerdist. Thanks again to GoToMeeting for continuing to support our little nerd empire. All right, so here we go, the Nerdist Podcast number 110 with Todd Glass, one of my favorite comics, and we're going to be starting a podcast with him soon, so you'll hear all about that in a second. Hashtag spoiler alert.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How's everyone sound?
I sound good.
Todd Glass, you get to be the new Jonah, because Jonah's not here.
I like it.
We're recording this early in the morning.
And that's quick. That's how quick you fire this up. Does someone else use this?
Yeah, sometimes. Well, I don't know if Ryan actually uses this stuff.
No, he does.
Does he? He's got his other studio in the building, though. He's got a couple studios in the building.
Well, you know.
I'm not going to lie. This is what I want in my studio. So if it doesn't look like this, I'm not going to feel
this
like it's
actually,
real.
This setup is not as technologically advanced as you think. We're actually running through a large board onto CD minus R discs.
Yeah, way to do it.
Which, like, this studio just missed this sort of computer revolution that would have made it to where we could just put things onto a flash drive or just upload them to a server.
What if you have all this, which looks, you know, there's a lot of equipment here, and then you go, well, it's actually not that complicated, and you press like the old-fashioned recorder where you press record and play. You're like, okay, here we go. Oh, that's it over there.
The reel-to-reel. Yeah. I have to like sit with the tape machine and cut the tape and tape it together like they did in the old days. This could be a lot cooler of a setup, but it's not. And we all had late nights last night, and of course I scheduled this in the morning, but I'm sorry because Matthew has to go work at that fruit stand computer store that he works at, so
it's gonna be a good time.
I have to go. I'm getting my new phone.
Is that what you're doing today? Good.
I'll not see you today there. I'll do it when I get back.
Fine.
I'll leave you alone.
Todd Glass, I'm very excited because
we didn't start yet, did we?
No, I'm not recording any of this.
It's our podcast.
If you want to say anything, you know, like that only we would hear, then it's not going to make it out.
This is a Todd and I's podcast reunion.
Yes.
Matthew Myra and Todd Glass did do comedy and everything else together. Mm-hmm.
For a long time.
With Jimmy Dore. Are you guys talking currently?
Well, so we're not on the air. No, not on the air, but if we started or not, tell me. I don't know. Yes, I never know.
We're recording.
Oh, we're recording.
Yes.
Oh, yes, we are.
Okay, good.
Yes. Yes,
why are you shaking your head violently? Why are you making that like cut?
Don't do that. When a friendship's had a little bit of, you don't need any jokes.
Brody Stevens used to do that when you would be talking to him, and then a bunch of girls would walk by, and right when they would get with an earshot of you, he would turn to you and go, "So why did you hit that girl?" And you'd be like, "I didn't." And there's nothing you can say that doesn't make you sound.
You look defensive.
Yeah, you just absolutely look defensive.
I still love the which we've been doing since high school. I think everybody's done a version of it where, you know, like my friend would be on the passenger seat and I would be driving, and then I would go, you know, girls would pull up next to us. I go, "But hey, do you like my red shirt?" And they look over, they see him wearing a red shirt. Not that he goes, "No, I don't."
You could say.
Yeah. And the other thing that a friend told me they used to do, I told him this, and somebody, a doorman at a comedy club told me what they would do was they would have a pickup truck. And then if you were sitting in the front of a pickup truck and there was three people, the person in the middle would honk the horn. The person at the end near the window would honk the horn real quick and then get down. And then for whatever the reason, girls would look over, anybody would look over and see two guys sitting next to each other in a pickup truck, which seems very immature,
sweet,
but very funny.
Those are fun. Todd, you have one of my favorite. Todd Glass is, as you know, Matt Myra, full of wonderful comedy games. And my favorite comedy game is the one where you're on the phone with Todd, and you put him on speakerphone, and he goes, "All right, listen, I'm just going to tell you a really sad story, and then when you feel like you've heard enough, just hang up." And he goes, "I dare you not to laugh
when you hang up."
When you hang up, it's fucking funny.
I've done it, and I've had it done to me, and it's so much fun. Even when you, like, I remember when I did it to you, and I go, "Matt, I got to be honest with you, Chris. It's just like, it's just been one of those months." And, you know, then with my mom passing away,
and then
I know you hung up, and then so I have to play the role of, "Oh my God, that's the worst friend in the entire world." And you're on the other end feeling like you're the coldest person hanging up on somebody. Like,
yeah, it's been kind of weird. I had to go into the hospital, but click.
Yeah. You see it? Oh, Matthew.
That's one of my favorite games. God. You guys worked together for how long? Did you do that show together?
A year and a half.
And we had fun. We'd drive from when we were doing
Yeah, every time we drove together, we would listen to Stern.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That was great because at the time I didn't have satellite radio. So we got to listen to Stern, and it was just like, oh, it was great. Just some classic Stern.
Hours in the car.
And now you're going to do the Todd Glass show for the Nerdist Industries.
Yes.
Which is exciting. That's a big announcement.
You know what? I really am excited about that.
It's going to be fun, man.
And I realized, I think the reason I'm excited is because since it was doing stand-up many, many years ago, starting it, it's the purest thing as stand-up is that you're doing. In other words, I'm nervous and I'm excited because it's all you. You can't say, "Oh, if they would let me do this or they let me do that." Like, you can do it, you know, in stand-up.
That's what I love about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I love. And that's why I always preferred stand-up over sketch or improv, is that you're responsible for all of it, the good stuff and the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. It's all you.
Yeah, somebody said that to me once, which I understand when it's going bad early in your career, it's more nerve-wracking than it is now. Now, it sucks, but you don't get as nervous.
Right.
You know, because you obviously have more confidence. But, so, you know, many people have said, my friends that I have in bands or in improv troupes or whatever, they go, "Yeah, but when you're going bad, you're out there all by yourself." I go, "You know what? But when I'm going good, when it's going good, it's all myself. And I'll take it. I'll take that." You know?
Yeah, but at least, like, when it's going bad, then it becomes, I mean, obviously it hurts a little bit. But then it becomes like an insane steeplechase where you have to see if you can navigate the course and pull it back out. And that's kind of the, you know, I don't want that to happen every time. But if I'm doing a run of shows and they're all going great, you start to get a little lazy, you know, you're like, these will be fine. And then there's that one that forces you to think and like get your head back in the game.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree because, yeah, I don't want it to happen all the time. It's great to just go out there and have a crowd that's great from the beginning. But, yeah, like I said, I don't get as nervous anymore unless I'm doing a corporate show. That can make me sweat like I've been doing it for a month. But when there's restrictions. But, like, yeah, if I'm in a comedy club and the crowd's a little
bit. Don't use words. A lot of these people here at this corporate gig, they don't like words.
Oh,
wait,
man,
what am I supposed to?
I can sweat.
What's the worst corporate gig?
You know what? That's the thing. And I know this. That for me, have you done court? You've done corporate shows?
Yes.
They're never. Most of the time, they go all right. It's just the restriction, and it's, you know, I've learned a long time. They go keep it TV clean. Well, they learned that's not good anymore because TV clean. A TV clean for me is easy. You do a lot on TV,
right?
But for corporate, it's like, you know, don't say this. Don't do a joke that has the word. You know, anything that could be misconstrued. I have a joke about, you know, getting lost, and someone. I'm going, literally, there's a watermelon festival.
Oh, right.
Which is a true story. There is a watermelon festival, mm-hmm. And on the way there, a friend wanted to get directions, and he pulled into a 7-Eleven, and he was going to ask black people directions to a watermelon festival. And I freaked out in the car. I'm like, no, that they don't know we're serious. It just looks...
Looks like you're being a dick.
Yeah, it looks like I'm being a dick, right. And that was one of them. I started to tell it, and I go... I can't tell that joke, you know, and then there's a million of those things, you know, like, and so I start sweating and then, it's like, you know, sometimes you have to do a half an hour and literally I'll look at my watch and I'm like, are you shitting me? I've done 4 minutes. Oh, and that's when I talk to the crowd, and I never care then. Like, if they yell out something, I laugh. I go, that's taking up time. I don't care. Anyway, that's not
yeah, corporate gigs can be pretty, especially because the money in corporate gigs is really good, mm-hmm. and so there's a little bit of a sense that they own you. It's mm-hmm. like you're there to do a job, and you never really feel like more of a product than when you're doing a corporate gig.
Yeah, because it is the money. I guess that would be the best place to be in your career where you go, you know what? I'm financially all right. I don't have to take corporate shows. But I know it's hard. The money's as you get bigger, the money just gets better. I had one, and I don't want to just curse to curse, even in my own act when I can curse. I've had nights where I get off stage. I went, I said fuck too much.
Yeah.
Just to say it to say it. But I don't want to not curse at all either because I just want to be like I am off stage. Sometimes I curse, sometimes I don't. But my point is I did a corporate show once. I thought it had to be squeaky clean. It was a little rough. I did like 35 minutes. I got off stage. I was honest with them. They're usually pretty cool. I said, man, that's just, I realized how much material I couldn't do. I swear to you. She goes, oh, there were no, you could have done whatever you wanted. So you know what? I go, I'll go back up. Half kidding. She goes, yeah, do you want to? I went back up, did 25 minutes. And first of all, just the fact that I told them what happened when I was up there, and then I killed for 25, 30 minutes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Oh, I felt, I remember when I got off stage, I went, oh my God, I can go to sleep now feeling good about myself.
I love that. Oh, you can do whatever you want. Do you want to go back up? Yes.
Yes, I'll go back up.
What do you say when you go back up for the second time? Guys, I know a second ago I was up here and there was a thing that happened.
Well, I went back up. Everyone was pretty much still in the room. So that's why I looked at the crowd when she said, because sometimes they file out in 2 minutes.
Right.
I said, yeah. So I go back up. They're all sitting pretty much. They brought the lights back down and I just said, what happened? I said, hey, I thought there were restrictions. I gotta be honest, it's a little tough, but they said I can say anything I want. So let's start by going, fuck it. And they all cracked up. And again, I didn't just start now cursing and being filthy. The set that I did wasn't, you know, incredibly different, but I could do anything I wanted to do.
What if you got superstitious and now for every gig you have to go up and do 35 clean, uncomfortable minutes and then get off and then go back? You try to engineer that every time. Do you feel like you can engineer that stuff? Or is that just, do you think like, no, those are just organic moments that have to happen?
Organic moments. Yeah, because I always say there's a few comedians that do this. It's not just one, so hopefully the one or two or three or ten that do it can't be upset because I'm not pointing out anybody. But that try to fake moments throughout their whole show.
Right.
You know, and that always makes me think, yeah, the crowd will like that once, but the crowd's not dumb. Or if you know what I say, if the crowd is dumb, okay, they'll fall for it. But do you want smart people to figure you out?
Well, it's hard because I feel like some of those moments, they spring from a different part of your brain than the part of your brain that engineers things.
Right.
And so that's why they can, it's a very thin line. Because I think people can see right through that stuff. Mm-hmm. They can see right through it.
Yeah, and like I said, if you fool certain people, okay, but like, there's a lot of people that get it. And I don't want to, when I said fool them, the people that get it, yeah, I don't want them to go, oh, I know what this guy does. So even if I could fool certain people, I'm worried about the smart people. No, I don't want to try to pull something over smart people's eyes. Is that my saying?
Yeah, smart
right?
people's sure. eyeballs.
Oh,
wait, I might be getting a text. Is this Jonah?
Oh, so sorry.
Oh, no.
No, not Jonah.
Not Jonah.
Do you return calls, Chris? You do. You're pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Do you ever have a situation? I have somebody now. I don't want to say who it is because we all know them. But if I knew, well, no, it's not. Oh, man. I swear to God, it's not. I swear in my mom's health, it's not. Matthew thought it was him. Like, I'd be that. Really to do it right next to you would be.
Todd, come on.
I swear to you, it's all not. Right. But if I think somebody, okay, granted, if I'm positive they're not mad at me or upset with me, it still might be upsetting. But it's less. Most of the time, I wouldn't care. Sometimes I start thinking, did I do something to annoy that person? Or so I get a little nervous. And there's somebody now, I'm like, I hope I didn't make them mad.
That's the problem with being, it is the downs, and a lot of nerds suffer from this, but comics in particular, because when you're a comedian, I think you're forced to get into your own head more than most people, than any other profession, because you really have to figure out who you are to, you know, I think, to be a really great comic. And the problem with that sort of hyper self-awareness is that you constantly dissect situations that you're involved in. And that, so that person that you think you probably offended, that happens so many times. You leave a party and then you're in your car and you're like, oh, I said that thing about big feet and then I realized that guy had big feet and he probably hates me now. And but what you fail to realize is most people are just thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
Like whatever that person, whatever you think you said, that person was already thinking about themselves by the time the last syllable came out of your mouth.
Yeah, you're hello.
Hey, Jonah Ray.
Jonah! Hey, what's going on? Buddy, how you doing, kiddo?
Yeah, very funny.
How you doing, buddy?
Not doing good.
Someone looks like you just rolled out of bed.
I didn't get to bed.
Are you
serious?
I didn't
get to sleep last night.
At all? That would explain the hair.
Yeah. I'm done with El Pollo Loco. I'm done with it. fucking done.
What happened at El Pollo Loco?
No, wait, what happened at El Pollo Loco?
What do you mean you're done with El Pollo Loco?
Do you have food poisoning? I had El Pollo Loco quite a while ago once. I remember that's when I was trying the Tim Ferriss diet for the first time, and I got deathly ill for an entire weekend. Deanna had to take care of me. I guess I just forgot in time that maybe that's what it was.
El Pollo Loco!
And so yesterday, one of the other shows here, Attack of the Show, just like they got a bunch of El Pollo Loco, and I was hungry. They said, oh, you can have some chicken. And I had a piece and all night. It started feeling weird after the show taping last night, and then got home and then just, not to be graphic, but pukes and poops.
Ooh, yeah. Can I tell you, getting, what do you say?
Why would you come in? I'm sorry.
That's good to see.
You're sick, man. You could have stayed home.
I have to come in anyway. And I like Todd a lot.
I like Todd, too.
Yeah.
I don't, for some reason, whenever I get, and I'd have to get, if I get, like, diarrhea from eating somewhere, it never makes me not eat there because I have that happen a lot. Like, even when I eat great food. So I go, I really can't just, it'd have to happen a lot for me to not eat there because I have it just.
So you have one of those maps on your wall with the little pins of like all the places where you got it. And like, oh, here's it. It's like a crime lab.
Brown for good.
Yeah, it would be everywhere.
Now, are you sure it's food poisoning or not like a stomach flu?
I don't know. I don't.
What is the difference between a food poisoning and
a stomach flu? Is like
a virus that you can pass to other people.
Yeah.
I went through McDonald's the other day, and the guy at the drive-thru, I said, how you doing today? He goes, even though he's just taking my order, you know, he's not the one. He goes, sick. I got to really get out of here.
Then
I swear to God, that's true. But at first I thought, well, he's being friendly. And I'm not a germophobic. What I call is common sense things. I mean, things that are, okay, you got to touch doorknobs. You got to, you know, what are you going to do?
Right.
But things that are like, I'm not going to. And he went to give me my change, and I figure if he's admitting he's sick, it must be real sick. I went, hey, just put it in the thing, you know, for the Ronald McDonald House.
Like, oh, that's really nice.
I wonder, and I thought, maybe that's a trick he does, you know, so, and then he takes some
of
the money.
That's how Ronald McDonald House gets a lot of money, is germophobes who don't want to touch the money. They're like, oh, just put it in the, maybe that was part of their ruse, like, tell the customers you're sick, they won't want to touch the change, we've got to help these kids.
You had no problem eating the food, though?
No. Thank you. Drake said, remember his joke about McDonald's?
No.
He goes, you know, they raise all this money or whatever. I'm probably bastardizing the joke. He goes, all I got is one question. How big of a fucking house do these kids need? Anyway. Well, you look good, Joe. I think
Joe, I feel terrible for you.
Oh, no. Don't cry for me.
Oh, my logo.
Why are we all wearing similar shirts?
I don't know.
That is true.
The one time Chris isn't in a collared shirt.
That's right. I'm just wearing a T. I'm just rocking a T-shirt today, you guys.
One of them T-shirts.
Yep. It's casual Tuesday.
How good is Matthew looking?
He looks fantastic.
Right. Let me tell you something. I was telling him before we got on, before we started the show, was, you know, even though I haven't, it seems like when I talk, it seems like I lost, you know, 1,000 pounds. But I eat, all I do now, I lost 25 pounds, and all I do is think about what I would have normally eat. Do you find yourself doing that, Matthew? Like, you're driving down the street, you go, I would have probably pulled in there. I would have probably gone there.
Yeah, yeah, especially when I see the 50 chicken nuggets for $9.99.
Oh, by the way.
Good Lord.
Gotta be a good thing. I'm not even, a long time ago, and my brother had to be 21. He goes, you want to be the coolest guy at a party? Show up like 1 o'clock when you're showing up late, 12.
Oh.
Go get 30 cheeseburgers at McDonald's. You know, what would it cost? You know, when we did it, it was like 50 cents a cheeseburger. Yeah. And he goes, you just show up with a bag of cheeseburgers. Everyone's hungry. And the other day, I thought, 2 buckets of chicken McNuggets
people
at a
go
party.
Shit. People
you got to be like, hey, I just thought.
Now, that's actually, yes, that actually, but would it look like you were trying too hard or everyone would be too drunk to care?
I think they, hopefully, oh, God.
I think they'd be so excited. I think they wouldn't think about it. They would just go, salt.
Normally, sentences that start with, you want to be the coolest guy at the party? Yeah. Do not.
Well, you know what?
You got to jump off the roof.
Are followed up by take this.
Yeah. By the way, keep in mind, that was my brother when he was 20, 21 telling me this in college. You know, but like, so you're right. Like, what if, hey, you want to be the coolest guy at the party? Put your collar up and wear a lot of cologne.
Yeah.
But yeah, college, that would, like, you know, that would be the coolest guy.
Right. But I think even now, you know, maybe I'm going to reword it different. You're right. I don't want to try. Hey, I'm the coolest guy, man. Hey, you want to do a nice thing for people at a party?
No, you want to be the coolest guy?
Yeah,
be the coolest guy.
Yeah.
Give everyone a ride home.
Show up with cheeseburgers, then pull your dick out of your pants and paint a rabbit nose on your cockhead.
I bought 100 tacos because it was $1.
Would that make you?
100 tacos, $4?
And put little whiskers on it. Like, hey, did anybody lose a rabbit? Guys, there's a rabbit loose.
Anybody? Come on. Anybody? Come on, I'm the coolest guy. I'm the coolest guy at the party.
You don't seem cool.
Show up like just blasting Def Leppard in your car.
Nothing wrong with that.
Todd, I've always appreciated, you know, your voice and point of view are so strong that I sometimes find myself getting into situations where I go, Todd Glass would never approve of this. Like, if I
give me an example and I want to go off
you
on
the,
it.
I'll give you the exact example. Because Todd has this uncanny ability to be able to assess a room and tell you what would make it a room that comedy would work well in.
Yeah.
Because there are rules. Like, you can't just, you know, like, so when you start, like, sometimes when you do these, when you do college shows and college kids are like, oh, we'll just have the comedian stand over there and you can just tell jokes of people as they come out of class. You're like, no. You need a little bit of setting. Well, so when I go into a room, because you have very specific rules for what makes a room friendly, and they're right. And so many times I see rooms, I go, Todd Glass would hate this. Yep. There's a fucking chasm in between the two sides of the room.
Well, and it's, you know, every time I talk about this so much, and I always think, maybe if I do a radio show, I won't talk about it because have I talked about it too much? But then when you bring it up, it's like coke to me. I go, I'll talk about it one more time. But I love talking about it. Don't get me wrong. It's the others. But it's not the colleges or the one-nighters that always get me, except when a one-nighter is being run by a comedian. We'll get back to that.
Okay.
But colleges, that's not what they do. But when a comedy club can't get it right, it's going to be the death of me.
Yeah.
It will be, because it's so simple of a process to do it right. And I'm glad that you said it, because I am right. I am right. It's you know, the things I'm talking about, it's not like little things like, oh, you should put 3 sofas in your lobby instead of 2. No, I'm talking about the hardcore basics of a show. And that's it. When you get into a room, it's like a movie theater. Look at a movie theater. That's how they do it, you know?
That's why it's fun to perform in town with you. We performed at the Improv one night, and you were headlining, and I did a guest set. And for some reason, there was a big space in between the middle of the seats, like, and people were separated. You're like, no, you gotta get everyone together.
That's why when I went to the Melting Pot, am I saying it right?
Are you talking about America?
The Meltdown.
The Meltdown, I'm sorry, I always say it wrong. I say everything wrong. The Meltdown, you know, even though I was like, oh, you should do this to the stage, first thing I saw, I was like, yes, they get it. They put the black curtain. Now, someone goes, they didn't always have it there. I go, yeah, that's even better. that you thought, hey, we should put a black curtain here. Mm-hmm. So when you enter into the room from the comic book store, you open a curtain and you go into where the show is
Thank you.
That's you?
That was mine. Yeah.
And there's a metal bar at the bottom of it that keeps it weighted so it doesn't blow open. Well,
but
those little things. And, you know, it's so simple. I remember, you know what? I don't know. Is this boring?
This is awesome.
I remember a long time ago, Sarah Silverman's sister, and this has to do when comics don't get it, because it's cheap to get. Sarah Silverman, Laura, did a show at this place that had done comedy five times before, and, you know, it wasn't even set up. And I went in there when Sarah's sister did it, and I went, you did this, didn't you? She goes, yeah. I give her a hug. I go, come here. Little things like when you open up the bathroom door, light would come into the showroom, mm-hmm. you know, where they had the show, and she put a black piece of material up. Probably cost her $4. So it just baffled. Is that the right? Yeah, baffled the light. Is that right? Put a baffle between whatever.
It confused the light.
Yeah.
No, when you open the door, the light
was flabbergasted.
I don't understand where to go.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
When you open the door, the light didn't pour into the showroom.
Right.
Yeah.
And then she had a few candles on the tables that were near the stage, and she said, hey, when people came in, just sit where there's a table with a candle. That way. And then, like little things like that. And then she had unscrewed the bulbs in the lobby so it was dark when you came in. And I went, yeah, that cost her, you know, $10. And then you walked into the room and she had music playing. I went, yeah, there you go. And she had a microphone that she pulled behind the stage and started the show. Hey, good evening. Welcome to Comedy Night. I was like, yeah. So when comedians can't do it right, it gets me a little upset. I'm like, you're a comic and you, but then I don't know.
Laura Silverman has one of my favorite jokes, which is, she's talking about something. She goes, but I mean, a little pussy never hurt anybody. Am I right, guys? I mean, unless it's a really little pussy.
Such a great joke. You designed the Improv Lab, right?
Well, I went in there to try to show, here's what you should do in that movie, in the documentary, I Am Comic. So I said, you know, I didn't know. No, I just, for that night I did.
Oh, okay.
That night. But they didn't, you know, and all, now there's a guy there, Jamie, that recreated what I did. But for a long time you went in there, I did it right. And then they don't recreate it.
What we should do is a show with you on Comedy Central that's a version of one of those HGTV shows. Well,
like Restaurant Impossible.
Well, you know what? I do have a show where I'm working with, I was working with Zodiac on a show, but now I'm...
The Zodiac Killer?
No.
You should really tell somebody. You should really tell somebody about him.
Well, I don't know. Who is that?
He killed a
don't pretend like you don't know because you're working with him and you're trying to protect his identity.
Because I am him. but I'm working on a show that would end up in, you know, DIY HGTV. And basically it's a simple concept where I go, wherever I go, I see a design flaw. It could be a house, could be a car wash, like my life. It could be a restaurant. And usually it's a quick fix. I go, because that's what angers me. If it was a big fix, if I went, they should tear this whole car wash down and rebuild it. No, obviously I can understand why someone wouldn't do that. They don't have the money. But it's usually I go somewhere, I see a quick fix, and that's the show, and I fix it. And so every week it's a different place, and I come. It's a cold open. I go, here's what we're doing today, and that's the show. We're gonna shoot a sizzle reel and then pitch it around. So
sizzle.
But if I could do that, that would be my dream show.
So do you think there's a mild kind of OCD thing where you when you see. It's like if my silverware is perfectly set up and someone slides my fork over, it drives me crazy. I'm like, why would you move that? You got to put it right back to where it was. Do you have a little bit of that?
You know what?
A lot of it.
I don't have it with germs, like I said, with touching things or anything like that. And I do like people over my house. So it's not like I have it so bad. I do want people over my house. And people that know me really well, I always tell people, if I clean up around you, my close friends get it. They don't stop talking. They don't take that as a sign as I want them to leave. They just go, that's Todd. And I love that. I don't want someone to go, oh, do you need help? No, just keep talking. Keep having fun. New people sometimes have to learn it. So I do like things orderly and, you know, and like things a certain way. I love organization. I love when, you know, when I always say when you go over a rich person's house, you know, I've been saying it since I'm little, everything's got a place and
they have enough room for those things.
What?
They have enough places to put things
in. They you have the drawer and it opens up.
You don't have to
be
rich to live like an organized person though.
Well, there is truth to that.
Your place is great.
I try. It's always a battle of like, I want that, like, you know, like I remember a long time ago, I have a joke about this in my act. I go, and I always tell the crowd, I go, by the way, it's not that I'm rich. It's since I was little, it's the what rich people do. And I say, hey, if you want to be poor, and by the way, you should do whatever you want. I go, do whatever you want. This is not, I'm just telling you the difference. poor people, you open up a drawer, they have, you know, soy packets, old spoons, ketchups, you know, if you, but you should do that. That's what, hey, poor people like to have a mop upside down near their back door drying. Hey, that, by the way, that's probably cleaner and it lets the mop air dry. I'm just saying that's what poor people do. And rich people do other things. Rich people roll their towels. I don't know why. That's just what they do. Poor people like to back their car into a parking spot. I don't know why. I don't even know why I even think that. But if you go, what? What's he talking about? You go, maybe he is right. I don't see
Quick
a
getaway.
Poor person. It's a white trash thing to back your car into the mall. More parking spots.
Wait, why is that? Why is that?
I don't know. And some
because
people go,
I like
no,
backing in. If it's easy, I'll back in because then when I get back to my car,
you don't have
it's time
think.
To go.
And you know what? You're right. And I've thought the same thing. Okay, let's say at the mall, especially at your house. But you could say the same thing. You back in. I don't know. That one I could lose on, but I think some people are going, I think he might be right. Even though I could have a reason, but, you know.
Well, I remember, yeah, I remember being in college and having a drawer full of plastic. So I think it's because when you don't have any money, you're like, I never know when I'm going to need this again. Yeah. And when you're rich, you just don't, you don't, you're not worried because you're like, I'll just buy soy sauce late. Like, you just don't, right. Not that I'm saying I know what it's like to be rich.
No, I know what you mean. You get to a point where you're the mindset in college where you're like, but you know,
even though I have a lot of money, ladies,
there's a lot of room in the back seat of my Mercedes for fucking.
With organization, like, here's an, I half like this theory of organization, but the other half I gave up. You know what I realized? I do. You're so into what you're saying. I've learned this when you re-listen to a show you're on. Sometimes I'll, you know, you do a podcast and you listen, and then somebody said something, and then you realize you're so into what you're talking about, and then you hear it, and you go,
"I would
get phone
calls from him every week telling me, Matthew, when you said that, oh my god,
it was so funny." I go, "What was I? What was I? I was just so much like, you know, on a path." And the path I'm on towards organization is not that important, but yet I see
that. Yeah, when I was a kid, though, I thought rich people drove Saabs and shopped in L.L. Bean catalogs. And then that's what I wanted to do. And then when I was like 19, I got like a Saab 9000, and I thought I had made it.
They're great moments when you
had heated
seats.
Have you had made it?
I did. It went downhill after that.
Let me finish my organizational thought here.
Please.
Go.
So I had this idea. Now, I half believe in this. I don't have junk drawers because you can't see everything, but I do behind my door into the closet. You open up the door and there's a, you know, those shoe trees that are clear plastic.
Yes,
you can see what's in them.
Of course.
Well, I have that for scotch tape. Sounds weird. You have someone's birthday once every 5 years. You need birthday candles. You go, do I have birthday candles?
Wait a minute. Yeah. What?
Yeah, just weird shit.
When do you need? When do you?
You know
need
what?
To
when I need it, I know that's a weird one to mention, but I know in one of the pockets they're in there because 3 years. But you know what? The day I'll come where I have them. But nevertheless, scotch
that's
tape.
That's what orders say.
Scotch tape, pens. But no, it's stuff I need. But here's where I don't have where okay. I took it down.
Okay.
And it has to do where you can borderline hoarding in my garage. I had five of them on a wall, and I just figured, you know, picture hangers, you know, my some knobs I didn't know what to do with. I got a new, and I put the knobs, and I might need some knobs one day. But you know what? I got rid of it because sort of, I go, I never know when I'll need it. You know what? It was just started getting junk in there, and I go, I'll buy it if I need it. So the worst thing that go, oh, but I threw out that blah, blah, blah. Good. Good. I don't need it laying around the house.
Speaking of knobs you don't know what to do with, Matt and Jonah, you guys... Oh, no, that was all. That was as far as I did.
Sorry.
I didn't realize
get that.
Nick!
Yeah. Oh,
hey!
How's it going, buddy?
How's it going? I was trying to be as quiet as possible.
No, fuck it. Don't
and
worry about it.
And you know what else? I used to get pictures. Like, you know, you take, you know, when you had, before you had old pictures?
Yeah.
I go, what do I do with them? I have a box of them. You know, I haven't, take the ones out that mean something to you, put them in a book, and people go, hey, throw them out? Yeah. Throw them out. Get rid of it.
Really? You know, that's funny that you say that because, I used to go to flea markets and stuff and just hoard old vintage things. And then I got rid of all of it. But there's one thing that I've been unable to throw away. I bought, you know, for like $4 of an old photo album. And it's all these pictures from this family, this couple, these people who traveled. And they're from all over the world. And it's all those really old pictures. Like, they were taken in the 40s and 50s. And it's all of it. I don't have the heart to throw that book away because I feel like I don't know who these people are, but they're memories that are just going to go away if I throw them away.
Well, couldn't you take How, like I said, there's 50. Take six of them out and then put them in a book.
I guess the whole thing is cool.
The whole book is
the
like,
whole
is
book is really cool. It's an old photo album.
Well, then you know what? I'm going to agree with you there, putting it that way. Then that's something you have out.
But that's so weird though, because I don't know those people. Like I don't know them.
Yeah,
I don't know them.
But it doesn't matter. That's the. I think what we're saying is that that still tells a great story. I don't know those people, but that book tells their story,
and that story you don't want to die. That's what's so weird. Yeah. I have no idea who they are. I don't know why. I don't remember why I bought the book. I was like, oh, this is cool. But it is. It is a catalog of someone's life and their travels from the 40s and 50s. The
weirdest thing at flea markets, I always find, is just
like why
the
sell someone's
old photos of like. Tons of photos. There's one guy at the Melrose flea market that just sells pictures upon pictures of buses.
Well, yeah,
like cool.
Photographs of buses, like with 3x5.
He's a child molester.
Buses, right? Matthew, when you have old pictures, you can sew them into a jacket so you can wear your memories. Noodle stores.
Here's how much that I wouldn't mind the original. And this is one of the things. I know this sounds weird to say it that way, but I always go. I'd have to have like you know, if I sell my first show and I can just give $1,000, you know, probably cost $1,500 to do this. My mom gave me some. She gave them to all of us. Like, she gave me a few albums and my brothers. So the ones I have, you know, they're the when pictures are coming out and it's sloppy. And I so much want to drop them off at a place and have it made into a book. Get rid of the original picture, scan it in. You know when they put the picture on the page, like the new way you make photo albums? Yeah. And get rid of those old junky. Just get rid of this sloppiness. Oh, I'll get another one, CDs. You know what?
I had compact discs?
I had CDs. Some people go, oh, but I didn't care. I thought, well, come on, man, do I care about... I don't care about the artwork. I just, one day, I took them. I have an iPod. All my music's on the iPod. I go, yeah, but that CD. I go, I'll get it. I took them, dumped them into the trash. I go, I could have dropped them off at a place. I didn't care. And you know what? I kept thinking about getting them out of the trash. I thought, was that stupid to throw them out? Well, I, 30 years from now, go, oh, I should have had... Nope. And when the trash guy took them, it felt cathartic. I was like, good, get rid of it.
I have like 1,000 CDs that are in storage, and I kept them around. I was like, oh, I might want to burn some of them. They've been in storage for 7 years.
You haven't burned any of them?
No.
Get rid of them.
You don't want any of it?
I guess I don't.
Yeah. Throw them out.
Can I sell them to Amoeba?
A CD unless I had a digital copy of it. Like I could not part with it, and I had to always double, triple check to make sure that I was like throwing it away. Looking at my iTunes folder, going, okay, I have it. I have it still. Throw away because I don't care about the packaging. But like, yeah, I need to. I still need the music. I still want the music. But.
Well, the downside is you might. Yes, I. And by the way, we talked about your the book of that family. Obviously, there's certain things. If you have 100 CDs and you go out and six really mean something to you, remember where you are, the artwork. Yeah, you save those. But the downside is if you throw stuff out that doesn't mean anything to you. Yeah, you might later go, oh, I could have used that. But the upside is you don't have shit laying all over.
That's true.
I would every time I watch Hoarders, I clean afterwards. Like it's like just seeing how filthy those places are.
That's how it starts.
How filthy you are.
Yeah, I'm like, oh shit, I haven't touched this thing in a year. I'll throw it.
Well,
out.
I had, you know, for me it was because when I worked at K-Rock in the 1900s. You would get all these promo CDs. So I just have a bunch of promo CDs. They're like, oh, you can't get this anywhere. This was just one.
This is limited edition.
Get rid of it.
CD.
How about people with their cars?
Jars of Clay, you guys. Yeah. Jars of Clay. I completely forgot about that.
What's Jars of Clay?
It's a band. I think they might be mildly Christian rock.
You know, I have a hard time getting rid of free T-shirts. I have a lot of T-shirts that I've gotten from working at record stores over
charity.
The years.
Give them to charity. You feel good.
Yeah, but they fit well.
Well, then keep them.
But then they're all piling up.
Then get rid of them.
But they all like make me
what
feel
did we
nice.
Do this for? Oh, well, they should keep them.
They make me look good. They make me feel
keep
good.
Them.
Okay. Keep them. Keep
but
them.
But they're just like, I got no room in these.
You should get rid of them.
But you know what? Then you should keep them. I could do that. No, there's. Hey, let me. You know what? That's another thing that helped me with the organization. Everybody has this with the socks. So let's say, forget about my. I don't wear dress socks hardly ever, but my black socks. You know that you wear with gym shoes. You know,
right?
You know, I would buy sometimes if I was at Nike, I would buy some. Then I had some here, and then when you have to match them, I got rid of every. It was the best feeling in the world. I got rid of every sock that I owned. And I went to Target because I know I can consistently get them there. They'll have them. And I got the gold-toed black socks.
Those are good socks.
And by the way, you know how there's ankle socks? Some are ankle. Some go up a little higher.
Yep.
Nope. All one. Changed my whole life. I don't have to get out. Oh, which do those match?
Yeah, I did that very recently myself. Because every time I go away, I buy the same socks, the Hanes black socks. And that's all I have now.
Give it to charity. Get rid of it. Give it to charity.
Here's this sock charity. Hey, you're welcome. You can use it as a mitt or a germ mask or a bra.
Sometimes I'm too lazy to go. The truth is, I don't give anything. Here's the way I do it. It sounds lazy. I'm sometimes too lazy if I have like some stuff I want to give to charity. So I know there's probably a place you could drop it off. I've never even looked into it. It could be right up the street for me and I should look into it. I just leave it places where I know someone will take it.
Oh, littering?
No. Yeah. No. Like there's people that go through my neighborhood and they'll go through the trash cans. So sometimes I'll just take like
homeless people. Where people? Werewolves?
They're not always, they're probably borderline. Sometimes they're just people that collect cans.
Okay.
Well, they probably are.
People who just became vampires and they're coming to grips with their new inhumanity?
The landlord called them transients in an email about the dumpster, and I thought that was weird.
Transients.
Well, I take stuff out of the closet. Out of the closet is the best for me. Out of the closet is a great place to take.
And you can just take, they don't say no to it?
Nope, you can take it. You just drop it all off. They deal with it. If you want, they'll give you a receipt. I take all my stuff out of the closet. There's one right on Sunset. There's a couple of them around town. They're great.
I didn't know that, so now I know. Yeah. Now I don't have to. Although my way isn't, my way, I think someone's getting it, so I'm all right with that.
Out of the closet's really an interesting place. Like, they give HIV tests to people. Like, there's AIDS awareness. I don't know. It's just a nice place with a nice charity.
Sounds gross.
Is it a...
Yeah, it's a thrift store.
You're a twat, Matthew.
It's such a great thing. And then the guy who just is so into like a few key words, just instead of it being the wonderful place it is, it sounds gross.
I don't want AIDS all on this new chair.
No, you guys, that's not how, they don't smear AIDS on chairs.
Yeah, well, then why are they there?
That's not what they, you're totally missing the entire.
Dirty sofas with AIDS all over
them? No, guys, they're not selling AIDS sofas. What are you doing?
Well, I'd rather go to a Christian place like Goodwill.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Where you Christian. Just get herpes.
Or these furniture pieces have been molested.
Todd Glass.
I used to pull over and get anything on the side of the road. When I first went to the music place on Sunset. Big
Amoeba?
Music. No. They perform. Where you perform there. House of Blues.
Oh, okay.
And they had like...
Music place on Sunset.
Did I say that one? But they you would go in there and they... It made me realize that I could do certain, like their artwork was like maybe an old window with a happy face on it that someone did with it. I go, I can do that stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't have a lot of money. Again, not that I have it now, but I can at least, So I was obsessed with getting things on the side of the road. Like I would see like a TV stand and go, I could do something with that. Yeah. Or I could do something with that. Now, the truth is, yes, I have found certain finds that, you could go, that was worth it. That was really cool. But a lot of it, I would lie how much it cost me to fix. I'd be like, I found that side of the road. It cost me $20 to fix it. Meanwhile, $100. You know?
Why do people always tell you how much stuff costs when they bought it at a vintage store? Like, it's always, you go, oh, that's a really cool jacket. Yeah, $12, man. $12.
$12.
Got it, Aardvark's. Why are you telling me that? I didn't ask you.
I think
you
they're proud of their find.
I guess.
Yeah, there was an old vacant lot sketch like that.
Oh, my God, vacant lot.
Yeah, it's like a... It's like, you like these boots? Yeah, rip off Doc Martens. Got them. $5. Everything he got was $5, and everything was ruined.
$5.
$5.
Holy
who said that? Paul Greenberg said that.
Love Paul Greenberg.
Who just said it now?
I did.
Oh, you said it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Todd, how long have you been doing stand-up now?
Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
30 years.
Really?
Yeah.
And where did you start?
I started in Philadelphia at the Comedy Works. And it was great. I've said it before. The club owner was named Steve Young. And I don't know if I would have gravitated towards knowing what good stand-up was anyway. Or maybe if I worked at the other club down the street where they didn't. I don't feel they had the good taste that he had. Mm-hmm. That I would have learned it anyway. But, I felt like, you went in there. A lot of times you saw guys like, this is before they were super famous, but they were sort of on their way. But like Richard Lewis, Gilbert Godfrey, Jerry Seinfeld, Jay Leno, Stephen Wright. Just a lot of great comedians. Roseanne Barr, Eddie Murphy had performed there when he had just done SNL. So it was like, it was seeing a lot of great acts and then made that. Jump over to Wednesday night, open mic night.
Holy shit. That's great. Well, so it's interesting because you've seen, you've sort of seen the sine wave that is the up and down of the comedy business in the last in the last few decades. But I feel like there's sort of a new boom, a new renaissance, and a lot of it has to do with podcasts, but just like, you know, the web and availability of venues and creative performers. And
I agree.
So when you pretty much surfed, you must have surfed the comedy wave of the 80s. What happened 10 years later in 91 when you started to realize, like, oh shit, all the clubs are closing down?
Well, you know, I sort of felt like I lucked out, because when I started comedy, yes, I would have done it if it didn't pay at all. I know that for sure. I would have been like one of those guys who was like, I loved it. It didn't have to pay me, but it did.
Right.
So very quickly, and, you know, there were so many clubs you were making. You know, I lived at home still, but I was making a living off doing stand-up comedy after 3 years, 2 years even. And, you know, wasn't a lot, but all my spending money, you know, was from comedy. Mm-hmm. And then I always felt glad when it sort of tanked that I wasn't big already, because then I didn't really get affected by that when it all went.
Oh, that's, you know, really interesting.
Yeah, the guys who were affected by it were, like, there were guys back then, which is a good thing. I'm not complaining. It would have been nice to be a part of that. You weren't necessarily a huge draw, but you did the Tonight Show 12, 13 times. So you just got paid accordingly out of it. Now it's either you put people in the seats or you don't, which is actually, it's okay.
It's
funny
how doing stand-up on talk shows just doesn't really mean anything anymore. I mean, it's fun and it's a really cool thing to do. And, it, you know, it's a nice piece of the puzzle, but, you know, like making that appearance on television doing stand-up one time doesn't change a whole lot.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, I mean, I'm sure it makes sense, too, because back then there were less shows. So, you know, although some people say it wasn't as dramatic as people make it sound. Like back then you did the Tonight Show and the next day the world knew who you were. Maybe that's an extreme. But yeah, you're right. If you did it probably a few times, five times a year, that people know, like David Brenner back then was an example, maybe right. That, or Jerry Seinfeld, I remember watching on there. But anyway, I do agree, comedy now, there was a period where you really didn't see any, you know, would see new comics, but a lot of, by the way, whenever I say new comics, there were also a lot of new bad comics never frustrate me. They're new. It's 25-year-old veterans that still blow, right, that make me go, really? New comic? He'll grow. But, you know, in the last 5 years or four, it's so exciting to go to, like, I went to Portland. That's the first time I really realized that.
Did you go to Bridgetown?
I did.
Yeah, great.
And I go, there is a shitload of new great comics.
Yeah.
And you know what's even the best part about it? I'll tell you who it was. You know when you hang out with a comic offstage and he's great offstage?
Yeah.
And he's funny and he gets it and you talk about comedy and you just go, this doesn't matter if he's been doing it 2 years and you've been doing it 25. You just, when they get it, they get it. You got so much to talk about. And then you see their act and you hope, oh, I hope they're funny. And you only hope that because in the past that's happened where you get along with someone off stage and you see their act and you go, ooh, they don't bring any of this to the stage.
Right.
Which is sad because obviously they get it because off stage they're funny and they.
Well, what do you think that is before you continue? What do you think that is? Like, what's the disconnect? Do you think people think they have to, oh, now I'm in comedy mode. Do you think they're too aware of what they're doing and that's why that they're disconnecting?
I know what it is because I did it. And the my savior was that when someone told me, I wasn't offended. I took it as a compliment. And you would think I would remember who it was, but it was in Philadelphia. I was probably 21, 22, and I was hanging out with a comedian during the day. And obviously, I was funny, and I got it. And he saw my neuroses, and he saw, you know, who I was. And he goes, why aren't you bringing any of this to the stage? And I was like, I knew it. Right then, I swear, I wasn't like, what? Hell, I went, I'm glad that he thinks I'm funny, mm-hmm. You know? And I started to, literally the next open mic night, I went, I gotta, fear. It's easier to do some processed generic act than maybe something, you know, that doesn't, obviously, and I know I'm talking to a room full of comics that know all this, and probably a lot of your listeners do, you know, doing something, it doesn't mean it has to be deep. It just means if it's going to be silly, what I learned then, this is, it should be Steve Martin silly, mm-hmm. You know, an inventive silliness. If it's going to be political, it should be, you know, so I thought, tap into that, you know, and I started to. So it was just fear. So when I work with a guy now, you see it. I know what it was because I lived it. But going back to this comedian that we thought, oh, I hope he's funny on stage, and it was Rory Scovel.
Oh my God, he's fucking amazing.
Not only do me and my friend are watching him, and we go, not only are we like, oh, we hope he's funny, but literally 5 minutes into his set, which just is fine with me. But it happened. I went, oh my God, I think he's better than us. Like, meaning that I learned something from watching him, which I love after 30 years to be able to watch Rory and go, oh, I gotta do, you know, I gotta do that. Meaning he lets himself go and he doesn't, you know, I always, especially if I smoke pot, I go down paths and I'm always going, okay, I gotta get back to where I was at, which sometimes is all right. If you're at a comedy club and, you know, it's on the weekend, sometimes, yeah, okay, I wanna get back to where I was at. But Rory sometimes will just let himself go and go. And where it ends up, it doesn't matter. There's no getting back to anything. It's just where he ends up. And I hope I'm explaining that right.
But no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I thought, God, that looks fun.
Yeah. Well, he's the kind of guy that will come on stage and think it would be funny to do a Southern accent for a good chunk and then just get bored with it and then kind of veer off into something else. Mm-hmm. Never mentioning, losing the accent, never mentioning, but still being just as funny as he was.
Yeah, no, I felt like a tool. I did, when I was performing in Atlanta last year, we did this after hours show that was in an old, like some comedy, this guy took, like squatted this old church building and basically started turning it into a performance space.
Oh, you're talking about Atlanta?
Yes. Oh. Did you do that room?
Yeah.
Oh, it's fucking great. I mean, first of all, Laughing Skull is a fucking great room. And then the after thing at this abandoned, like
Oh, it doesn't matter, but it's great. It's downstairs.
Mm-hmm. And you walk around the building and you're sure it's haunted because it's just this old church, but this guy who runs it has turned all these different rooms into performance spaces. And so
one in the morning,
the show starts at 1 a.m. And then Rory, I followed him and he basically just fucked around in the space for, you know, like 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I went up with my dumb written jokes. I'm like, God damn it. Like, it was so, his was so much more suited. But I feel like what Rory does is, you know, like, I mean, I haven't seen him in a giant venue. Because when I think, oh, I should just go up and just have fun with the space and fuck around, that's harder to do in a theater setting where it's a larger venue. Like those are great sets when it's a little more intimate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know what I've learned, and believe me, I'm right with you, that I meet in the middle. Like, I want to try to do, you know, what I watch him do sometimes, and I do, and it's fun in those little venues. But then when I'm like, I learned this when I opened up for Louis C.K., that you still have to do when there's 3,000 people. Yeah, you got to project. But I learned that I could meet in the middle. I can't necessarily do what I did, you know, with 30 people. That's got to be something special when it's 30, 40, 50 people. But I don't have to go always to this act that I thought I had to go to in front of 3,000. And Louis one night said to me, he goes, Todd, he goes, by the way, just, you know, I love you. This is all. I go, no, go. He goes, you don't have to go out there and do the best of. He goes, I want you to do good. He goes, and you will. He goes, but sweat. I like when you sweat.
Holy shit.
And I go, are you sure? He goes, matter of fact, I'm positive. He goes, you go out there, just do it, you know? And you know what? It was great. It was fun. And I had the excuse of Louis to do it. You know what I mean? Like, if it didn't go well, I could go, you know. And yeah. I think once I cheated a little, I went, Louis told me to sand the edges off of this rough theater. So that's what I'm doing. So don't get mad at me. Which then they sort of, but, you know, and then I sort of started doing that every night when I opened for him, was like, just, you know, it doesn't have to be.
Do you write? You know? Do you actually sit down and write, or do you just come up with ideas? Because I saw you do a bit one night at the improv where you came on stage and you said you were a cop. You're like, I'm trying stand up, but I'm supposed to be working. And you had them play this. You gave them a CD and you're like, so I got to keep the police scanner on. I'm really sorry. So just kind of quietly in the background, you hear the whole time. And you would tell a joke. And then when people start to laugh, you go,
I did that. My notes used to be sloppy because my handwriting is so bad that I couldn't even write notes that I would read, or I would get sloppy with it. But there's a girl that helps me. Her name is Dana. She's a friend now. She helps me out. And I memo into my phone the notes, which you can give a real clear, crisp note when you're verbally saying it, like, you know, because you're not worried about spelling words, at least with me. And then I just memo it right to her and she adds it to my list of jokes. Mm-hmm. And then she sends them over to my house. So now my notes are great. But for a long time, that's only in the last year. Before that, just horrendous notes. And I just write notes. Like, I don't write out bits or anything. But
because I love the idea of, you know, especially with Louis, I think Louis never really wrote anything down before even just a couple years ago. And he's one of those guys like Attell where they just sort of get an idea in their mind and they just go up on stage. I saw Chappelle do the same thing. And they just work out their beats on stage, which is, and to me, I don't necessarily work that way. So it's fascinating to watch that process.
Yeah, I've learned to again meet in the middle with that. Like, I'm not Jerry Seinfeld, which by the way, I'm not saying that in a negative way. Like, he's a wordsmith. I'm more do like that way, like where I work it out on stage. But I learned I can like take a little bit of the Seinfeld. Like, I'm getting ready to do my hour special, and I am trying to figure out, okay, you've done that joke a million different ways every night on stage. Which way does it work the best?
Mm-hmm.
Because I want it, the night I'm doing the show, I want it to be the best.
How many times will you give a bit before? Because, you know, I'm sure every comic has that bit that in their head, they're like, oh my God, this is gold. And then you can't make it work for some reason. How many times will you give a bit before? I have a bit that I've given like 8 times, 10 times. I can't make it work. I'm about to just like set it on fire and push it out into the lake.
Twice.
You give it twice?
Sometimes I'll give it twice. Unless someone can give me a legitimate reason why it's not working. Go, here's your problem with that bit. You know, you got to tweak that. Then I'll go, oh, okay.
I do it a lot because I feel like what happens sometimes is that the missing element sometimes can just be comfort level for me. So, you know, like bits that I do once or twice and they're not selling, when I get comfortable with them and they just sort of sink into my skin a little bit more, by the 8th or 9th time, sometimes they can come to life because I'm very, it's very fluid and I feel comfortable with
it. Well, the worst one is the one you try first and it kills, and then you try it a few times after that and it just doesn't.
Yeah, the disappointment of, I have a new bit. Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah, that's when that happens, that's funny. You shed a new light on that question. Then I might go 8, 9 times. Yeah. I go, come on, that worked. It didn't work. It killed. And then what's going on? And that's the advantage of taping your set. Even though I know how good that is, I don't know why. In 30 years, I've taped my set. You know where you walk up with the recorder, you tape yourself. Accidentally, you know, you're working on a Conan set or something, and then you have the camera and you watch it. That I've done a few times, but literally where I purposely walk up, especially with the phone now, drop it on the stool, tape it. I've done it once. And when I did it, I went, oh my God, this was 2 years ago. I see why people do this. I found out why that didn't work. That worked. That was new. Oh, the cadence and that. I go, I want to do this all the time. Like, I couldn't believe it. No, I've never done it since.
I record a ton of sets. I just never listen to them back. No. Which is stupid.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's no excuse. My fucking iPhone has voice memo, which records.
I do 15 minutes every Sunday that I'd never record. And I just go, what the fuck?
Now, there's no excuse for you because you're starting comedy.
Exactly.
Todd, would you hit him in the face? Like, you should. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Wow.
You need to be doing that, Matthew. That's the only way you're going to. You specifically. You have to do. If you. Listen, you took the time to go part-time on your hours and to start doing this open mic. It is you're talking about 15 seconds of your life of hitting record and stop and making sure the file's saved.
I literally am ready to go with it, and then I forget.
What could make you do that? Because he's so right. Like, even though I'm sitting here saying I didn't do it.
But you've been doing comedy for 30 years. He just started.
I set an alarm and...
Do
it early.
You know, for me, it might have been a fear of anything technical. You're tech savvy, so you know you can bing, bang, boom, done.
I'll say this. Sometimes when I'm thinking about recording a set or taping a set, I get a little bit of anxiety because then, like, I am in fear then of myself later that night listening back.
It's kind
of like an ostrich move where you're just like, you know, I don't want to know. I just want to kind of be in the moment and not think about it.
I have the same thing with recording for, like, a set. I go, oh, I don't want to. It's so funny. It's like, I'm recording even to try to get, like, you know, work on the process of getting on whatever show, Letterman or Conan or Kimmel. And, you know, you have to record yourself and, you know, video. And I feel like, you know, Jonas does. I'm like, oh, I just want to have fun. I go, what do you mean? I can't have fun if I'm recording myself?
Yeah,
I go,
you get in your head. You know, it's being, you know, it's not just going into the memory banks of the people there. It's going onto the old disc.
How many times have you done? You've done Letterman.
I've never done Letterman.
Oh, you haven't?
And you know what? I have to say, because I don't want to be one of those guys that's always like, I should have had this and I should have had that. Letterman is my fault. Eddie Brill actually has been so, you know,
Books Letterman.
He's been helpful. He's been like, hey, I like that. He was very cool the way he said it. He goes, you can take my notes. I thought he was very fair. And he goes, let's work on the set. And I know when I say this, it makes me feel like, really, you're that lazy? And then I, because of what Jonas is saying, I like every time it's ready for me to work on the set, I go, you know what? I'll do it later. And then the year passes and I go, oh my God, it's been a year and a half since I talked to Eddie on those notes. And then I go, well, I'm doing my hour special. Maybe then I won't have to, you know, I don't know. That's just, but I've done Kimmel a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They've been unbelievable. And they don't even check my set out. Like, I'll tell them what it is on the phone. And they've always trusted me, and I guess, you know, I've never really let them down, I hope. So they've had that rapport where they just say, and I have an idea for a weird bit, And then they just let me do it. So that's been fun.
You going to wear the lav again?
What?
You going to wear the lav, Mike?
I like that. Yeah. Last time, I think, or the time before, I wore a suit, which I don't normally do. I probably would never do again, but it was fun. And I had no microphone. I just wore the, you know, the like mm-hmm. old times when yep. you did. It was sort of, it sounds weird, but it was
you
fun.
You like having your hands free?
Not always, but that night it felt cool. Like, I felt like, you know, when I grew up, you watch a comedian. He didn't. I remember the first comedian had a microphone. I'm almost positive this was true, and it was a big deal back then on The Tonight Show with
Carson?
Johnny Carson, was Paul Provenza.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, because he had a bit where he used the mic stand, I think, for something, and they said, you know, and so it was like, I remember, like, after you watched him, you were like, hey, he had a mic stand last night, he had a mic stand. No one used a mic stand.
Oh, wow.
Not that he considers that self, oh, that's my what's groundbreaking about me, but it was an interesting side note that...
Paul's a sweet guy. I like Paul.
Yeah. He's doing stand-up a long time also.
Oh, my God. Yeah. One of my first... When I was at UCLA, I was in this thing called the UCLA Comedy Club, which was basically this group. We'd meet once a week and help each other flesh out bits, and we'd do dorm shows a couple times a year. And whenever we'd do a dorm show, the dorms would pay us. We'd get paid as a club, you know, like $100 or whatever. And we would save up money and then be able to bring in a headliner. And so Paul Provenza was someone that we paid to be a headliner. But this was like 91, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And so we paid him, and he headlined for us. Do you remember the Santa Monica Improv?
Yeah.
Where they shot Evening at the Improv?
Upstairs,
they had this like loft, this little lofty space with a smaller room. And so we booked it out and did a show there. And, you know, and then Paul came and he headlined the show.
That was, by the way, when you talk of a small space, that was a great small space.
It was perfect.
I felt like it was like, I always say to me, the perfect little place is like when you go into a jazz room in New York and it might only hold 60 people, but it's run like Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
You know, the ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome. And, you know, and the lights go down and then there's a spotlight and the sound booth might be 3 feet by 2 feet, but it's smushed up in the corner and there's a guy up there and the spotlight's up there and it follows the performer through the crowd. And so it's 60 people, but it feels special.
Yeah.
I love rooms like that.
I love small rooms.
Yeah. They can be magical.
I would I would rather, you know, if I got to the point where I could sell a shitload of tickets, I don't know if I would necessarily want to play like a 2,000 seat place. Like, it might be fun, you know, like you like two or three shows at five or 600, you know, mm-hmm. where you can really, because I really love interacting with the crowd, and that becomes very difficult when the room is larger.
Yeah,
because then people in the back don't know what the fuck you're talking about. They can't see the person in the front. But, you know, that sort of intimate, we're having a communal experience as opposed to I am talking at you.
Yeah,
it's nice.
I always say that, like, and by the way, to be very clear, if tomorrow I had, you know, that type of success where, you know, 2 years later, you know, you're selling out 5,000 seat rooms, I'd do 5,000 seat rooms, I'd do 8,000 seat rooms. But I've always fantasized down the road when you're like maybe Jerry Seinfeld, where you go, okay, this is a tour for my pleasure. I don't need this money. I can't imagine doing a 5,000 seat room. You know, to me, I open up for Spade in Vegas, and that room holds about 850. And that's still pretty magic. It's pretty intimate.
Yeah.
It's like 850. So I feel like that's the number.
Which where room?
It's at the Venetian.
Oh, okay.
Palazzo. Just a great warm room. Even the worst. It just feels pretty intimate.
Is so it like stadium seating or is it like?
It's stadium seating.
That's
and
awesome.
And it really tiers heavy. You know, once it starts lifting, it goes up. So it's very, they're just
those
like
fun.
Wrapped
You've been working with Spade
you.
For a while.
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun shows. You know, do 20. I mean, I love headlining, obviously, because you go out, you do. It's fun to do an hour of material. But opening is also because you do. I do 20 minutes. Fun weekend. You know, enjoy Vegas.
Yeah. So how often do you are you constantly cycling in new bits?
You mean in my? I always say it this way: if someone saw me a year later, I would have half new material at least.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, like, you know, this is something I always talk about with my comedian friends is like, well, I'm doing an hour special and then I'm afraid to go on the road and do the best of. I always feel like, hey, if guys like Louis that do the hour every year new, I mean, like, obviously I'm in awe of that, you know, to watch that process. But I think if you're for the crowds, I think not one person would complain. And I only say this from someone who went to see comedy before I did it, even at a young age. And I would, or even once I started doing it, and I would still be going out to see shows. If I went and saw somebody a year later and it was half new, I'd be like, oh, it was great. It was half new and did some of the old bits. I wouldn't look at it. It wouldn't even be a bad thing. It wouldn't be like, it was half new. It would have been nice if it was all new.
I still love, you know, because as many, you know, I would say my prolific comedian friends are people like Patton and Paul F. or, you know, and every time you see them, they have a whole new chunk and you're like, fuck, it's gorgeous and brand new and polished material. Oh, I still wish he had done that one bit about, you know, I still get that way as a comedy fan. Like, oh, I want to see you do that bit again. Yeah.
Yeah. You definitely want to see new stuff, but I feel that way about all the Patton and Paul too. And then Brian Regan, the same thing. Like, you know, I went and saw him, and it was, I mean, I'll go, I loved it, and it was all new, but he did a few of the old bits. I was like, oh, yeah, and it's fun with your friends, you know, you're still the same way. You're like, oh, you're going to love this bit, you're going to love
it. I have a question for you. I wrote a bit that I really like, but the way that the only way the bit works, it sounds like a Brian Regan joke. Now, it's not a Brian Regan joke, but I feel like the mechanism of it is really more in his voice. But I really like the joke. Should I do it or not?
That's a great question.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's because that's why I understand why certain comedians don't want to go out and see other comedians, because you're like, oh my God, they'll start rubbing off on me or whatever. But sometimes it's just you, it's just a bit. It came from within you, yes. But you, as you're telling it, I have a bit or two like that. And sometimes when I'm telling it, if I hear it in my head, I'll go, oh, maybe I should give this bit to Brian Regan. And then I do Brian Regan, you know. But that's a good one. I don't know. What are you guys?
Because I don't know if maybe maybe it's just in my head it sounds like him, but in the way that I present it, it's like to other people, they would never think, you know, but it's just a bit that sort of formed in my head. And when I kind of worked out the beats of it and I said it out loud, I was like, oh, I don't know. That sounds like, you know, like it sounds a little bit like Brian Regan.
But throughout my set, I notice, like, I'll surprise myself where I'm like, oh, that last line I said sounds like Paul F. And then, like, the way I ended that joke sounds like Mitch Hedberg. There's weird, like, I think there's, like, tinges of it, but there's never really one bit I could say it sounds like someone else.
I might try it. I'm doing, by the time this airs, this will have been weeks ago, but I'm doing the Comedy Bang Bang, formerly Comedy Death Ray, tonight. I think I might try it tonight just to see how it goes.
How fun is it to go in there and see? I feel the same way about both spaces, like that
the meltdown
and Death Ray, just to see like how excited like everyone is in the audience. And you know, some people, once in a blue moon, I feel like people that don't work those venues have a preconceived notion of what's there. And I go, let me tell you something. Maybe that exists sometimes, but all I know that those venues exist are people that are watching a show that are real excited and attentive to be there. So attentive that when a moron is in that crowd, how good are those crowds when if somebody looks at their phone too many times during a show? At a comedy club, that wouldn't stick out. You wouldn't be like, oh my God, I notice it. But most comedians don't. They're all such great audience members that when someone does something bad, it's like, you know, you stick out like a fucking moron.
Yeah, because they're mostly, you know, they're mostly comedy nerds who go to those shows. And right. So they see a lot of shows and they, you know.
And I feel like, you know what, I always want to, and maybe that's why I'm saying it now so they know it. And I'm not just saying this. When I go into those two venues especially, I feel like I want to let them know you're such great audience members. And I think because of it, I think they reap the benefits of being such great audience members. And I want to show bad audience members. See, this is what you do. Yeah. If you don't know what to do, go watch them. If you're a confused audience member, I don't know what to do. But you want to still go out and see comedy? Go out and watch those audience members. Go sit in there and look around the whole show and go, oh, this is what you fucking do.
Well, you know, the difference is like, Most people at comedy clubs don't see comedy all the time. If you see comedy all the time, you just start to become aware of how you should really be watching it. Like I don't know. It's just a different. It's a difference between taking an upper division physics class and taking a physics 101 class. Mm-hmm. You know, like people who go to the UCB, that those are upper division comedy watchers. They've seen a lot of shows. They know like all the hacky shit that works at clubs because people haven't seen a lot of comedy before. It does not work at UCB. And so you just have to, you know, you all understand that you all kind of know what's going on. It's nice.
Let me ask you this, because even at a, are we okay with time?
Yeah, we have like 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Like, I always say this. I wouldn't ask anybody to do anything or expect anything from an audience that is unfair.
Right.
So whenever there's someone not behaving at a comedy, even at a regular comedy show at a just a good comedy club, I always think, well, wait a second. Look around, same thing at the rest of this audience. Everybody else gets it. So it's gettable.
Right.
And that makes my anger escalate immensely. Because it's like I'm not asking them to. I go, everybody else gets it. So it's gettable. Now, let me ask you. Are the rest of these people in this audience, sometimes 99% of the audience. So we're just talking about one table of seven. Mm-hmm. So if they get it and they're doing it right, are they like brain surgeons, super smart, or average intelligence, or what are they and what are you? Like, look around. If they get it, it's gettable. Are they wrong? Are they wrong? Because let me tell you something. I fantasize about, look, are they wrong and you're right? Or do they not get it? Are you sitting in your car going, yeah, we went to a comedy club last night and everybody just, they just like listened and laughed.
Yeah, no,
they didn't yell. They didn't talk. Yeah. Obviously, they don't know how to have fun. Get the fuck out of the club and die.
That's what makes me crazy. Get the fuck out of the club and die.
Yeah, and by the way, because you know I'm not crazy, painless.
Right.
I don't want anyone to die in a painful death. I don't care what someone does. I want them to have a painless death. I don't want to say.
You're right.
No terror involved. No terror. Just drop dead.
In your sleep.
Right.
Fade out. Yeah. I say that about, by the way, I'm half kidding. About that. I'm all kidding about that to make my point. But I'm not kidding about people that are hateful. I've said this before. If you're prejudiced and you're prejudiced, if you're whatever you're prejudiced about brings, you know, it makes someone else's life suck. You know, if you're sexist or you're homophobic or you're racist, my first wish is that you would change. That's a good wish. That's my first wish. I blow out the candle. I'm wishing you could become a better person.
And you have candles because you've got them.
I do have the birthday candles. Yeah. But my second wish, I think I'm serious about this. And I want to over it. My first wish is that you'll change. My second wish is die. I'm 100% serious about it. In your sleep, die. You are worthless to this society. I would rather you die than you inflict your pain on someone else. So yes, in your sleep. And if I was sicko, I'd go die a death of pain. No pain at all. Absolutely no pain. Go to sleep and drop fucking dead.
That's fucking serious. Fantastic.
I am serious. Some people go, come on, you're serious? Yeah. No, I should pray that they're here to bring their stupidity onto other people. That's what drives me
crazy. Like if someone shouts out a dumb heckle and they think they got you because you get mad, you're like, no, I'm angry because what you said is so fucking stupid and hacky. I'm angry that you're that stupid. There's nothing more dangerous than a stupid person who thinks they're smart. Like, that, I think, is one of the most dangerous things in the world.
Yeah.
There's stupid people who think they're smart. And you're like, you're too fucking dumb to know you're not smart.
Misinformed and stupid.
You make me angry. Well, listen, we have a couple things to cover before we get out of here, because we just have a couple minutes. But number one,
I got a plug fest here.
You have a plug fest. First of all, you and I first met both doing an episode of Married with Children.
We did. I always
bring that up to you. Back in 1997.
I was so, you know what? See, I know we're going to close here, but I've told you this before. It's funny. I was so nervous.
Really?
Like when you came over, I was like, hi, how are you? Because I knew you were, you know, because I had seen you on TV. And you know, you're like, I'm like, hi, how are you? And like, I thought you were hanging with them. And I looked over and you're talking to all the, Married with Children. You knew all the people in the show. And you were like, hey, what's up? And I'm like over there with my one stupid line. I couldn't even remember.
Todd played a cop.
Yeah.
I played a VJ. How did I get that role?
Can you do me a favor? Can you give me 30 seconds to just
rip
through this?
I want you to plug the shit out of whatever you want to plug. Because people, listen, I cannot recommend Todd Glass enough to people. They have to see you live. Your live shows are so much fucking fun.
Thank you. I do appreciate that.
And so hopefully that's what you're about to say.
Yeah, the El Rey is on August 6th, and that'll be my tickets are available there. That's my one-hour special. And then to get ready for it, we're going to shoot it. I'm going to the Comedy Bar in Toronto, and I'm going there this Wednesday, so whatever that date is. Comedy Bar in Toronto. If you live in Toronto, call the Comedy Bar.
Okay.
I start on the 20th of July.
This might not post by then.
Okay. Well, then I've been there, and it was great. And then the Laughing Skull
the last week of July, the last Wednesday through Sunday of July. I'm at the Laughing Skull in Atlanta. And again, if you've never been there, they do every single thing right.
Yeah.
I have a blast there.
Marshall runs that place, yeah. So it's a gorgeous space.
What a great little venue. And then my new podcast, The Todd Glass Show, which I have, like I said, I haven't been this excited and nervous as since when I started stand-up. And,
I'm so glad you're doing that, and I'm so glad that we're going to produce it for you. I'm not even 100% sure what your show's going to be. You said you wanted to do a podcast, and I was like, okay, whatever you want, whatever you want.
Yeah, that was, no, it's funny, because that's when I got nervous. I'm like, wait, there's no guidelines? If it messes up, I
anything
can't blame
you want.
Chris.
It's all you.
Chris is making me play music.
All the time. You stick to the playlist. Yeah. You know, Smash Mouth at the top of every hour.
and thank you, Subaru, for giving my mom a Subaru. God
did
love
really?
You. Yes, they did.
Are you serious?
Wow. Yes. Subaru
I
rocks.
I retweeted that.
Why did they give your mom a Subaru?
Because they're nice. Because I had done a live remote out of their headquarters, and we talked about my mom wanting a Subaru, and some time had passed, and this is, you know.
We got to start going big. Like, I always feel bad for, like, yeah. Gaffigan, who made a big bit out of Hot Pockets. Like, oh, great, I have fucking Hot Pockets all the time now for life. Yeah,
well, that's my new tag phrase, but they didn't ask me to do it. Matter of fact, they've asked me not to do it. After my jokes now, I go, Subaru, vroom, vroom.
Todd Glass, you are a delight. Can people follow you on? Are you on Twitter? You're on Twitter.
Do you know that Subaru has the highest safety rating out of all cars?
You know, I was not aware of that, Todd. Yeah. That is a weirdly gorgeous fact that is completely unmotivated.
Well, if you want to put your kids in an unsafe car, then buy another car. But if you want your kids safe, buy a Subaru. Well, on my website. Is what? I'm sorry. Yeah, I have a... What did you ask me?
Twitter.
Yes, I'm Twittering. It's Matthew. What is my Twitter?
At Todd Glass.
At Todd Glass.
And your tweets are as solid as the construction frame of the Subaru, which, by the way, has a very high safety rating.
my tweets were horrendous for a while. Thanks due to all the people that follow me for being patient. But now I'm trying to getting the tweeting thing. Okay. You know, for a while when I tweeted, I had to call the people to do my website, verbally tell them my tweet, and then they would print it.
Really?
Because I was that bad on the phone. Now it's different. Now I'm good. Matthew has been a godsend. Helping me.
Good.
Imagine getting those calls at 3 a.m. Matthew.
How do I send a tweet?
I'm sorry, Todd. It's just a few characters too long. I can't do it.
You need to get it down to 140.
What? 140. Oh, poor Matthew.
All right. That's the end of the program.
Enjoy your
Subaru.
Burrito.
Vroom, vroom. Vroom, vroom. Subaru, vroom, vroom.
Is it vroom, vroom or vroom, vroom?
Subaru, vroom, vroom.
Is it like vroom with a U and an umlaut?
V-R-O-O-M.
Okay.
Vroom, vroom.
So what about Subaru, vroom, vroom?
Ooh.
Oh, well, I saw your eyes light up. Oh, my God. What? We're going to call these Subaru.
Hey, can your fans tweet Subaru and say Subaru rocks?
While you're at it, tweet out Aston Martin for the fucking podcast.
Thank you, Chris.
I just want to take down I'll take a DB9.
DB9. Corolla's got one.
What if you said so low? You go, can you tweet? I need, I just spit something out of my mouth.
We did five podcasts a week. We could all have one.
Yeah.
Guys, let's tweet out $1 million.
$1 million.
That worked for some asshole on YouTube. $1 million homepage.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by GoToMeeting, the easiest, most reliable online meeting service. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com, promo code Nerdist.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.